Hey, plant friend, quick announcement at the top of the show. I wanted to let you know I'm offering two different free online classes that are 45 minutes each that are designed to help you get the most out of your spring this year. I want spring and summer 2025 to be your best houseplant growth seasons yet. And the way that you'll sign up for these classes, which are completely free, is by going to growingjoywithmaria.com/class. There's two options. The first up is the Spring Houseplant Boost. Supercharge your plant growth in three simple steps. And this is a 45-minute class all about how to utilize spring to set your plants up for insane growth this year. And then the second class is called The Ultimate Guide to Moving Indoor Plants Outside and Three Mistakes to Avoid. A lot of people move their plants outside in the spring, which is fabulous, but there are massive mistakes you can do that can result in some pretty bad stuff. So this class is going to go over how to do that. If you're interested in either classes or both classes, you can go register for free, completely free. Each class is 45 minutes at growingjoywithmaria.com/class. That's growingjoywithmaria.com/class. I cannot wait to hang out with you live and share my tips. Imagine a garden where the plants thrive without constant intervention. A place where nature does most of the work and all you have to do is sit back and enjoy the beauty. That sounds like a dream, right? But what if I told you it's not only possible, it might be the future of gardening because it's more sustainable. In today's episode, we are diving into the world of naturalistic gardening, and you might just discover a whole new way to approach your garden. Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants. Hello, plant friends. My name is Maria. I am here to help you care for plants and grow joy. If you're new here, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome home. So honored to be part of your planty journey. And today we are having a bit of a heady conversation, a bit of a philosophical conversation, as well as a very practical application that you'll be able to apply. Lots of things you learn. Today I'm joined by Kelly Norris. He's a renowned horticulturist and author of the new book, Your Natural Garden. Kelly has made a name for himself advocating for gardens that work with nature and not against it. And in this conversation, we really explore this concept of naturalistic gardening, the concept of place, the concept of honoring the land that you live on, and how in doing that, you can create a more sustainable, beautiful, and low maintenance garden. Kelly's insights might inspire you to rethink your own gardening practices, tear up that lawn and plant some more flowers, and cultivate a more harmonious space with nature. I'm so excited for you to hear this conversation. Here we go. A very belated welcome to Growing Joy, Kelly. I know that, you know, I think I invited you to come on the podcast 5 years ago and life got in the way. So I'm thrilled to have you now here.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. I love your book. I think it's so perfectly timed. I feel like I get more and more questions about this type of gardening, but I feel like natural gardening can be really intimidating and confusing. So I'm excited to kind of dive in with you today.
Let's dig in.
How did you become the plants man that you are today with a real focus on ecological gardening? Like, what's that journey look like for you?
Well, I've been gardening since I was a kid, really. I mean, I grew up in rural Southwest Iowa, and I was as fascinated by plants in my grandma's garden as I was by the plants growing in a 40-acre prairie a quarter mile up the road from her farm. I'd later learn that prairie wasn't just any ordinary kind of hay field. It was actually a pretty special place that is still home today to two species of federally threatened plants that I had the fortune of experiencing when I was maybe 12 or 13 years old. And so it set in motion for me a kind of binary curiosity about plants, like plants in wild places and plants in gardens. Mm. But in college and graduate school, I realized there aren't two places. There's just one world. And maybe
did you go to school for horticulture?
I did. Yeah, I went to, I have a bachelor's and master's from Iowa State in horticulture. And it was through all that, that, you know, that idea that, you know, there's nothing separate about our gardens from the world around us.
Yeah.
I kind of began to take root.
That's beautiful. Yeah, the merging, right? I mean, I feel like what we're learning now so much is our ancestors had it right and we messed everything up.
There's been a lot of human activities on this continent long before people from Europe came here to sort of figure it out all over again. So there's, I think there's a long, you know, rich history of people and plants all around the world. And I think we're wise to look backwards as we look forward sometimes.
Yeah. And even, I mean, if you go back to ecological, you know, planting, gardening, naturalistic gardening, whatever we're going to call this practice we're going to talk about today, it's really not even talking about our ancestors. It's like, what does the earth do naturally? And how do we just best set it up to be more like what it used to be, even before humans interacted with plants at all? Would you say that's right? Or it's really about the first iteration of humans and plants interacting?
No, I think there's definitely a cue here to take from, you know, the natural world, simply put. But I think it's an art of noticing, right? It's an art of noticing that, you know, plants are alive in the world, and that life that they have is as rich and complex as the life that you and I know and I think of as ours. We have the benefit of being able to move on 2 feet. Plants don't. So imagine, I once had it explained to me, and this might be a bit of an overstatement. Any true plant biologist might cringe a bit, but it's a reasonable approximation as an analogy goes, that imagine having all of the sensory power and capacity that you and I have, and as a plant being stuck in the same place forever, your whole life, with all of that capacity to experience life as you may know it. And again, it's there's a certain, maybe something romanticized about that comparison, but it's worth thinking about that, you know, plants are tremendous organisms, and plant life is something we understand a lot about, but there still is very complex. And maybe the whole idea about this is just to trust other life forms a little bit, to just put plants in the lead and think maybe we can partner in this gardening thing and not just think that we have to control something.
They're so much more resilient. I mean, I cut my hand with a mandolin this week and I basically haven't been able to use my right hand all week. And then I think about redwood trees who literally withstand forest fires. Like, the redwood tree wins over me every single time.
Resilience is an important component of thinking about natural gardens. It's something we think about a lot. It's a word we put into context to say, you know, sustainability gets a lot of tread out there in the world, maybe a little less so. I think it's kind of been overly used, overly stated. And sustainability is fine. You know, the problem with sustainability as a concept is that it requires you to quantify the resources you're going to apply towards something. Like anything sustainable, if you assume it has some X quantity of resources associated with it, it's the resources, the delimitation of those resources, that's the problem or the challenge of the future. And so however you define that, water, temperature, CO2, whatever. And so, you know, the question becomes then, if we think about resilience as sort of a capacity to regenerate and respond and kind of, you know, adapt and just sort of take a swing at whatever life throws at you, that's a different thought process. That's a different mindset than just talking about sustainability.
No, totally. Totally. We're saying naturalistic gardening, natural gardens, ecological gardening. What are we talking about? Like, what are the many different names of this kind of gardening practice that you specialize in? And how is it being expressed? Like, my friend called me the other day being like, we're rewilding our backyard.
Right.
So there's so many different terms that people are really using to talk about trying to restore our land back a little bit more to what it used to be like. So what are those words? Like, walk us through for the people who really don't know what we're talking about.
It's a words group out there. It really is.
Yeah.
I write a little bit about this in the book. I'll share one of the early essays in the book is, what is a natural garden?
Right? Yeah.
And the first thing to think about when you try to answer that question is you have to think about the fact that your garden today, in whatever form that may exist, is part of an ecology of place, whether you know it, like it, can name it or not. Like nothing pays heed to your fence or your garden gate, right? Or your balcony. I mean, life moves, right? So your garden is already connected to something. And when you start to embrace that idea that your little patch is some little square or tile in the mosaic of a much greater landscape, there's a consciousness that suddenly comes to mind to say, gosh, well, what, you know, what is my patch doing for the other patches? How is it connected to the other patches? How is it affecting other patches? It's like leads to more questions, right? It's a more generous mindset. And so that idea of that your garden's connected to some bigger picture is sort of the first step in defining that. And then being aware of what actions you may want to take, what you want to plant, how you want to live with the space, what you want to do in it. And, you know, the sort of ripple effects that that has for the environment, you know, in a larger sense around it. I think that's the first kind of way to sort of get into it. And it's to frame it really as an act of thinking consciously about, which is in and of itself an ecological idea, is that you're not separate, but you're very part of something.
Yeah. How do native plants play into this? Because I think a lot of people think pollinator gardens, native plants, like those are also all words. Like, what are all the words that are associated with this style of gardening?
You know, native is obviously a word that gets thrown around a lot. And it's a word that means a lot and nothing at the same time. You have to have a context associated with it. Native to what?
Right.
Where? At what scale of nativity? I mean, you could say, you know, you could say of a plant, it is native to North America, it's native to California, it's, you know, native to, you know, Mendocino. Like you could, there's like a level of great of geographic distinctions one can make there. And at each level of distinction, it means something different, right? Like,
right.
Or it means, maybe it's like, you know, nested dolls. It sort of means a little bit more with the scale at which you define it. And so that's the first part. And so it humors me, as I'm sure you can relate as an author, is like when you see a review of your book or somebody shares with it, and it's like, he didn't mention any native plants. It's like, first of all, where are you at?
Right. My native plants in Florida are different than your native plants in Des Moines. Yeah.
What does that mean? I mean, maybe that statement is true, but what do you mean? And so that's, you know, that's 2025. Like, what do you mean? Like, what are you saying? So native plants factor hugely into this conversation and thinking about plants specifically that are native to at least your region in an ecological sense, which may have nothing to do for that matter with your geopolitical boundaries.
You know, mm-hmm.
I'm in Des Moines, Iowa, and the ecoregion that defines the nature of this place is huge by comparison to maybe the nature of a place
like me, where I'm in South Florida. It's basically the tropics. Very different and very small.
I mean, the gradations of, you know, the eco-regionality of a place like, you know, a peninsula like Florida out in the middle of the ocean is, you know, you have a rich biodiversity, but there's, you know, across most of your state, there's a lot more in common across Florida than there may be, you know, across the whole of the upper Midwest that accounts for the tallgrass prairie ecosystem that is naturally our heritage. You know, you have to put a pin on the dot map somewhere. It's like, well, what am I trying to say? A native natural garden, rather, has some foundation of native plants to your region, but you have to be able to.
Yeah. So a natural garden is connecting to what naturally existed in your place, in your area. And my natural garden is going to look very different than your natural garden.
Absolutely. And I think I think you're 100% right. The only thing I would add to that too is that it's not only a conversation about looking backwards. It's not simply about restoration exactly in terms of its exact composition. It's also thinking about the reality of the nature of the places we live today, which is disturbed in ecological terms. You know, our cities and our suburbs do not have natural precedents, right? There's not really a novel. They are in fact a novel kind of ecosystem that doesn't have a historic comparison. And so that doesn't mean that the landscapes of natural history aren't relevant. It just means that they're not whole in comparison. A ecologist that I took classes with in college used to say, you can restore any ecosystem in its composition. You can't restore the atmosphere that ecosystem evolved under a few hundred years ago. And so you have to be aware of the fact that even together, the composition put in together in the same way may not yield the same effect.
Yeah, that's interesting because I remember when I moved to South Florida, I grew up visiting family in Florida. There were orange trees in ground all the time, citrus. Now I'm in South Florida. I have multiple citrus and the citrus aren't doing well because there's a new invasive species that's basically taken out most of the citrus where I live. And that wasn't a problem a while back. But now in my garden, I'm thinking about citrus differently because of that species. So that's kind of an example of, or like all the weather changing that we're experiencing. The USDA hardiness zones got you know, reclassified a couple of years ago. So that's kind of an interesting take on looking back, but then also looking under your feet, where are you actually placed right now? And what are those circumstances?
It's funny because, you know, as we learn more about place, you know, it's like the dog chasing the car, right? Just as soon as we get to it, it drives a little bit faster away from us.
Right.
And place is not static. It's always in motion.
Yeah. So along the lines of curiosity, you are full-time, you call yourself an ecological designer, landscape designer?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So you're an ecological landscape designer specializing in these natural gardens. What are some examples of what that can look like from maybe, you know, a patio or a little balcony to some of the larger scale projects that you've done?
Yeah, no, I mean, we work at all scales and our work looks like where we work because we work in what we call a site-specific fashion. And so we want the landscapes that we create, you know, to be rich and vibrant and experiential and full of life and connected to the ecology of their place, as much as we want them to feel like they look like where they belong. You know, what makes your part of the world look like your part of the world in South Florida versus what makes Des Moines, Iowa look like Des Moines, Iowa? We want to capture the here that makes landscapes look like here, wherever here is and not there. And so,
you can get specific about Des Moines, though, and where you are, because I am curious to kind of see what that looks like in different footprints.
It's a cold place. It's a very cold, mid-continental temperate place. Cold winters, hot, humid summers. You know, a lot of our work is here in the upper Midwest, increasingly a little further afield. We work at all scales, I think, as I mentioned, 200 square foot condo gardens that are super cozy and lush, all the way up to doing master plans for big spaces like farms and or ranch. We have a ranch project in South Dakota right now that just allows us to think about the landscape at a lot of different scales and think about the processes that affect why a landscape looks and does what it does. A lot of what we do is about creating the most intimate, immediate landscapes to houses, dwellings, that sort of thing. But we also get to think about how are these going to change at some scale over time? I mean, what systems are we kind of creating here in a net? We're playing natural systems designer. What are we trying to create for the long term here too?
So we all remember to water our plants, but how often do we remember to protect our skin while doing it? Plant friends, if you've stuck around, you know, a few years ago, I was diagnosed with melanoma on my face from sun damage. I thought a little garden sun was harmless and those rays added up and I learned the hard way. And since then, I rarely leave the house without sun protective clothing on. And that sun protective clothing is usually Coolabar. Coolabar's UPF 50 plus clothing blocks 98% of UVA and UVB rays. It's sun protection you wear, so you don't need to reapply like sunscreen. You don't need to smear sunscreen all over your face only to sweat it off during a day in the garden. You just put on the hat and the cover-ups that Coolabar makes, and you look cute while doing it. A wide-brimmed hat is a non-negotiable in the garden because baseball caps leave your ears, neck, and cheeks exposed, and that's exactly where I got my melanoma. I love Coolabar's Brittany hat. It's cute. It comes in so many fun colors. You can wear it in the garden and out and about, and it has a wire in the brim that you can shape. And while tank tops may seem comfortable in the garden, protecting your chest and arms is so crucial, plant friends. And Coolabar makes breathable fabrics like Activathon Air and ZNO. Their blends make full coverage feel effortless even on hot days. My go-to is the Devi Long Sleeve Fitness Tee. The Cooltect fabric is so cooling and sweat-wicking. I'm finding I'm using it even on the hottest days because it's actually more comfortable than sweating in a tank top. And if you want a zip-up option, I'm literally wearing the Luma Leo zip-up hoodie right now with the matching pants. It's a set. I wear it almost every day. Protect yourself this gardening season, plant friends. As you go to buy plants, get protective gear for yourself. Protect your skin, please. And you can get 25% off your order at coolabar.com with code GROWINGJOY25. That's coolabar.com, C-O-O-L-I-B-A-R, with code GROWINGJOY25 for 20% off. You know, it's stressful times and we've got Mother's Day, Father's Day, wedding, celebrations coming up, and it is time to get some gifts. And what I really wish that I had is a magic wand that could take all of my loved ones' stress away.
and make their life more simple, more soothing, more calming. And unfortunately, plant friends, that magic wand doesn't exist yet, but I have found the next best thing, and it's Wind River Wind Chimes. So for the last couple of years, these wind chimes have truly turned my home into a sanctuary. Whenever I hear them blowing in the wind, it is this gentle moment to take a deep breath, to pause, to exhale, to be present. They have brought me so much joy and relaxation, and I am gifting that joy and relaxation to everyone in my life right now. I cannot imagine a better gift to give this Mother's Day, this Father's Day, for upcoming weddings, upcoming graduations, especially because when you use the code GROWINGJOY at checkout, you get a free engraving on the wind sail of the wind chime that you get. And you can engrave that wind sail with a special message, a date, a name, and in memory of. And it makes the wind chime so special. And also it makes whoever you gifted the wind chime to think of you every time it blows in the wind. I just gave my mom one for Christmas, actually. And I engraved her favorite saying, "I'm a lot of fun," on the wind chime, and she is absolutely obsessed with it. So gift your loved one something they're obsessed with this season and something that relaxes them with a Wind River Wind Chime, and get that free engraving. So you're going to go to windriverchimes.com and use code GROWINGJOY at checkout for your free engraving. It's a gift that is going to soothe the soul of whoever you're gifting it to. Once again, that's windriverchimes.com with code GROWINGJOY at checkout for that free engraving.
Yeah, so what did that 200 square foot condo garden look like?
It's hardly any light because it's the courtyard of kind of a brownstone like building. Okay. And it maybe gets 3 hours and 45 minutes of sun a day. So it's a very lush place though. It's cool. So we used a lot of native ferns. There's some great architectural components that allowed us to do some fun container installations and kind of permanent window boxes that then the owners can kind of, you know, fuss up for a little color. One of those happens to be on the balcony that overlooks the courtyard. So very sunny by comparison to, you know, 20 feet below it. So we were able to create a space that had a lot of dimension to it. They had kind of an ugly set of doors that led onto the garage that was connected to the back of their unit. So we did a graphic wrap that played off the textures of some of the plants. And so it all sort of just blends, you know, together into kind of one surface that covers this sort of historic brick facade that it frames the walls on either side of the courtyard. So it was a terrific challenge. I mean, not what we normally do, but to create something that was very dense and diverse and lush, all within a hyper urban footprint.
Is the idea that you're planting this very densely, very lushly, you're replicating or you're looking to inspiration of the grasslands and meadows that are classic in Des Moines, yeah, like the land that you were talking. Yeah. So you're trying to kind of replicate that. Is it that ideally there's not irrigation needs? Like ideally it becomes kind of self-efficient?
Yeah. Both of those things are true. And I mean, in the case of what we did in that courtyard, you know, we have historic woodlands. And so this felt like kind of, you know, recreating a little tiny postage stamp of woods, even though there was only one tree. Well, two trees, I guess. One kind of a dwarf maple, but they had already planted a parodia, a Persian ironwood, when they moved in 25 years ago, which was even then a pretty unusual tree, all things considered. But it's very urban tolerant, very shade tolerant, all this. Even then, because it's so shady, the canopy of the tree has never quite developed its full form. So it's not actually exerting that much shade. It's kind of trying to reach in a leader-like fashion towards the light. So we were trying to create a little postage stamp of woods. But yes, the functional aspects of that mean that, you know, by creating a dense ground plane, you are conserving water, certainly. You're reducing weed pressures because we're using a matrix of green vegetation right at the surface of the ground. So there's just immediate practical benefits to all this stuff. It's not just about a ethics or a morality about looking backwards to go forwards, but there's just real-time functional benefit. Nobody goes and weeds the woods, right?
Yes.
Nobody's maybe paying that much attention to every square foot of the woods that you might be in your own courtyard behind your apartment either. So, I mean, maybe that's a relative comparison. But, you know, in this situation, when that planting is fully filled in, it's spilling out onto the hardscape that's there. There's not any open soil anywhere.
Right. The urban environment. Another thing I have to ask you, you said it gets 3 hours and 45 minutes of direct light. How do you measure that? How was that an assignment you gave your clients to be measuring and checking every hour? Or that that's a guesstimation.
We use an app called Sunseeker that it's a handy little thing that you can click into a 3D view. So you can actually use your phone's camera at any real-time point, and you can see overlaid of the image coming through on the camera where the sun tracks at different points of the year, where you're at today. And so it helps you kind of calculate at a certain height where the light is going to travel and how much you're going to get. I think we often take our measurements at like 36 inches or so off the ground and use, you know, that's taller than a lot of plants are going to be. So some plants are even still in really more shade below that. We use that as kind of a reference point to say, you know, how much. So we're getting light on the walls. You think about this courtyard being a very square, tall, you know, rectangular box. And, you know, there's light up on the walls at the top and certainly light on the balcony level. But down there in the courtyard at ground level, none of that angle of light isn't in our favor based on where the sun's usually at in the sky. So it's pretty shady.
That's an app you can download on your phone?
Yeah, iPhone and Android, I believe. You can just in the App Store. It's free. It's super.
Oh, handy. My gosh. I just moved and I want to start a little cut flower raised bed garden for my neighbors on my front yard. And I've been like setting reminders every hour to like go see, has the sun patch moved? Where's the sun patch right now? So that maybe I should just try Sunseeker. That would
Sunseeker.
Be
there's one online called SunCalc. I've used.
I think I've tried SunCalc. Okay.
Yeah, I think SunCalc is another one, but we used to use that, I think. But the Sunseeker is so easy because you just put it on your phone.
My God, one of the most valuable things all came from this conversation. Not that everything else isn't good, but I'm so excited about that. It's just an immediate pain point you just helped me with. Okay, so that's an interesting condo. So what about if you had someone who, you know, we got a lot of like beginner, novice, intermediate gardeners gardening at their house. So what if someone comes to you with a front yard or a backyard that they want to bring in more naturalistic plantings? Like, what are the elements that you're thinking about when you're trying to set up a natural garden for a little bit more space that isn't so unique that for that specific condo situation?
Yeah. So I think the first thing we're always looking at is how can we increase vegetation? I mean, the bottom line is you're going to end up with more plants, right? Because plants are the sort of foundational components of an ecosystem.
Actually, can you speak to that a little bit more? Because that was a big part of your book, like more plants.
Just keep
plants. Why? Yeah.
Things eat plants. Plants produce. Yeah. They are the producer level organisms across the planet, full stop. And so, you know, oftentimes in a traditional landscape of a conventional nature, we have through, you know, or for aesthetic reasons, simplified both the diversity that's in that landscape and maybe even the abundance of any one of those plant choices.
Yeah, the spacing guidelines terrify you when you go to the store and it says, don't plant this. This plant needs 14 inches of space. And then I'm like, oh my God, it's going to die if I don't give it that 14 inches.
Yeah. Spacing is one of those things where I used to write, I know what this is very keenly, because I used to write tag copy in college.
Oh, really?
My little side gigs was like writing copy for the companies that produce the databases for plant tags. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of crazy. You start to think, well, who told you that? I mean, who measured this? Who figured out that? And there's a certain degree of, you know, it's an optimal measurement, right? It's thinking about like, well, if every plant in your garden was a precious little snowflake and you wanted to give it all of the space that it needed to develop to its 100% full maximal potential, what would that look like? Okay, so that's where that spacing comes from. But plants don't grow like that in nature. Plants grow at incredible levels of density, and they live cooperatively and sometimes competitively in situations that are stressful. And so there's a value that comes from density that starts to look like a more natural system. So oftentimes when we go into a setting that maybe a lot of people out there are looking out their window right now going, yep, that sound looks like my yard, right? Like there's these shrubs that are spaced all the way, all the way apart. Somebody said, oh, they'll fill in. That's the other horticultural myth. It's, oh, they'll just
right, they'll fill in. You have to plant it separate. So you give them space to fill in. Yeah, but then for 6 months, you have this like scraggly looking space.
6 months, 6 years. I mean, it's amazing. Sometimes I see lens, you know, folks we know out there in the world who are, you know, planting things that in nature would be growing inches apart from the next most likely individual of that same species and out in a landscape setting 24 inches apart, like they're somehow magically going to just fill in. Like it just doesn't work that way. So we're always thinking first, how can we get more vegetation in here? But you know, we're humans. We need a place to have a barbecue and to sit, put a fire pit and kick a ball and do all this stuff, right? A place to walk, let the dogs out. So, you know, we need to do a standard kind of inventory of like the functions that people need. But here's the deal. When most people that we talk to, we come up with that kind of list of how they're going to use the landscape. We can still oftentimes find a way to totally amplify the vegetation that's there without a lot of effort. Because when it comes right down to it, picking on lawn for a minute, most of us have way more turf grass per capita than we actually use or for matter need. There's actually nothing wrong with turf fundamentally. It's our relationship with lawn. That's the challenge.
Yeah, right? We're odd.
It's a toxic relationship. It's like we got way too much of it out there. And most of us, it's not the turf grass's fault. It's fault of things we think we need to do to it. And so what we're interested in finding is to say, how do we right size those things? How do we find the best fit? So we still get lots of plants, lots of habitat, lots of complexity. Those are the ecological things we're thinking about, but also a space that you can live in.
Yeah, I'm just sorry. I'm distracted because I'm thinking of my lawn and I'm like, yeah, I never walk on my lawn because I have my walkway. Like, yeah, I mean, I don't have kids yet, but so then you identify what places you're going to kind of, I guess, rewild is one of the, you know, top names. And then how are you selecting plants? How are you selecting more plants? But what are you intentionally bringing in?
Well, one thing that we think about as we start to organize our plant palettes for projects, you know, we do that site study, right? We figure out what's going on, you know, in the soil. What are the history of the soils tell us? We can put, you know, you can log online pretty much anywhere in the U.S. and query a map that the USDA produces to find at least historically what the soils tell us about the vegetation that maybe once used to be there. You can, I mean, in a city, that's usually not very helpful because the soils could have been stirred up, imported, inverted. It's hard to say sometimes what happens, but you know, it's a starting line, right? So we try to get to know as the place as well as we can. We look at plants native to our region, the kinds of plant communities and the systems we might be trying to maybe not recreate, but evoke in our work, in our practice. And then, you know, we start thinking about how do we put those that, you know, oftentimes a big mood board full of plants and ideas into a layered composition that makes sense close to the places that people live and work. And so one of the techniques we use is we think about, you know, these kind of design plant communities is a series of layers. And so we have kind of a, what we call the matrix layer. It's sort of that foundational, you know, green understory that's holding the thing together. We think about structure, which might be a tree or might be shrubs or things that help frame the landscape in a way. Maybe you don't want to look at your neighbor. Maybe you want to have something nice out a window. You know, we create a certain scaffold. And then we fill in the, you know, the in-between spaces with what we call vignettes, things that are lovely and pretty pictures and then that nice combinations that also have the added benefit of being oftentimes floral and thus resources to pollinators and the creatures that use them in that way. And so, you know, we're kind of always sort of in those three angles, figuring out how do we put together something that works to create just a little more functional piece of the landscape for you and for everything else around you.
I just found your new favorite gardening overalls because they are mine, and it's not the brand you think when you think about gardening overalls. It's Dovetail Workwear. Dovetail Workwear is the largest exclusively women's workwear brand in the Northern Hemisphere. They're made by women for women, and they have teamed up with John Deere, a little name you probably have heard of, to create a brand new collection of functional, size-inclusive, and flattering clothes designed to empower female farmers, crafts and tradeswomen, small-scale homesteaders, and gardeners like us. I got to sample a couple of the pieces while I was planting up my lanai, and guys, the overalls are hands down my favorite product. They are this gorgeous hunter green. You've probably seen them on my Instagram. They're high-stretch, mid-weight fabric. They are so flattering, even on my body, which really doesn't fit into overalls quite well. Honestly, if I still lived in the Catskills, I would wear these overalls out, like on a Saturday night. They're so cute. I love that this collection is so intentional. It's co-created with female farmers and growers so that every stitch, every pocket, every feature is really made for real work and real women. And you know, we're working in our gardens this season. One of the examples I love is the overalls and their cultivator shirt has this twine hole in the pocket. So if you have garden twine or garden string that you're stringing up your tomatoes with, you can put it in your pocket and pull it out and the twine never gets tangled. It's kind of genius. I will be in these overalls all garden season and probably out and about as well. So be my twin plant friend. Grab a pair today and get 10% off by going to dovetailworkwear.com/growingjoy. The discount is applied at checkout. It's limited to one per person. That's dovetailworkwear.com/growingjoy. In today's episode, if you've been thinking about how to garden more naturally, more in tune with the rhythms of the earth, then let me introduce you to my favorite gardening partners, Espoma Organic. Look no further for your garden products. Their products have been helping me grow joyfully, sustainably, and organically for years. Because naturalistic gardening is all about supporting healthy soil and ecosystems, and Espoma's been doing that since 1929. They make gardening in an organic and naturalistic way so easy. Start with their Biotone Starter Plus, follow up with their Plant Tone and their Holly Tone fertilizers. They have a fertilizer for everything. You can use their composts. If you're growing in beds or containers, you can use their potting mixes or their raised bed mix. Everything is made with organic ingredients and beneficial microbes that feed your soil and your plants. So whether you're establishing native perennials, building pollinator beds, or simply trying to reduce your inputs while increasing your beauty, Espoma Organic has an organic solution that aligns perfectly with the naturalistic philosophy. To find where your local Espoma dealer is, you can head to espoma.com, or you can click the link in the show notes to go to my Amazon storefront where I've curated all of my favorites so you can shop online. Thanks, Espoma.
I love that. So now, say I'm here in South Florida, or we have a listener in Arizona who's listening to this episode and is like, I want to think about plant palettes. I want to think about this. How would you recommend we go to start learning about what we should be putting in our plant palette? Because like you said, my palette is going to be very different than yours. Are there resources like a website or something like that that we could go to just to start getting? Because for me, my biggest pain point here is because I just moved to Florida and I lived in actually zone 5B my entire life. Like, I don't recognize any, I don't know the names of any of these plants. I knew everything when I was up there, and now I'm in a totally new area.
Yeah.
People who are maybe houseplant people who are just stepping outside also might not really necessarily know all the names of their trees and their whatever. So where do we get started if we want to go find our own plant palettes for that?
There's a lot of places to start. That's maybe the bigger issue is that
okay.
There's so many resources out there. You know, one of the things that's happened in just the last 5 or 10 years, there has been such a resurgence of interest in this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of native plant society, almost every state and even sometimes multiple within the state have native plant societies that publish. Mm. You know, just lists and often very beginner guides to just figuring out what the nature of your place is. Apps like iNaturalist can be really helpful in that way, too, because, you know, there's a kind of user generated aspect to iNaturalist that can sometimes not always be 100%. Right. But it's valuable.
But you'll like catch the vibe. You'll get the idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just have a little insight into what's happening and what's going on. And, you know, the dialogue, even the discussions in places like that can be quite helpful. Those are good places to start. Every region of the country oftentimes has folks that are writing specifically about those topics as it relates to landscape design or plant choices. And I mean, there's just been such a, an outgrowth of all this. National Wildlife Federation is another one that comes to mind where you can kind of zoom into different regions of the country and see, for instance, lists of keystone species. The plants that are natively part of that, those ecosystems that are kind of doing the most work. You know, we live in an incredible biodiverse world, but nature kind of runs on the 80-20 rule in some ways. You know, it's oftentimes a handful of very generalist powerhouse species that are accounting for a lot of the biodynamic activity out there in the world. And so those, you know, across the world, oaks, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, are big. You know, big keystones region to region. You know, there's just hundreds and hundreds of species of invertebrates and then birds and other things that utilize oaks, for instance. And so that's kind of an example of looking at, you know, what are the, if even if you had to like get the top five, like what are the most valuable keystone species to kind of make my garden relevant and connected to the world?
This is good. You're giving us a lot of search terms, keystone species, native plant societies, natural wildlife federations, iNaturalist, great app. Also, what I'm finding too with this new resurgence of interest is a lot of botanical gardens are even curating parts of their gardens in this more naturalistic way. So you can go and get insight because totally. Something that I'm struggling with is, you know, the old advice when you move to a new place is go walk around your neighborhood and look at what your neighbors are doing and then do that. but your neighbors aren't necessarily using native plants. They're not necessarily, they're doing some of the old ways. So I'm like, well, what's the right natural plant versus the like landscape kind of, not invasive, but the like for show landscape plant, you know?
I really appreciate you underscoring the public garden aspect of things. As somebody who's, you know, spent a good chunk of his career in public horticulture, those are tremendous resources in local communities all over North America. The American Public Gardens Association and the American Horticultural Society have a partnership called the Reciprocal Admissions Program that if you're a member of American Horticultural Society, you instantly get a free membership for those almost 400 gardens now that are participating. It's a great way to start to, I mean, it's a great way to travel too, to find gardens when you go places. But
yeah,
in your local communities, whether it's a park or a botanical garden or an arboretum, these are institutions that are, as you say, very much focused and living in these issues day to day, because it's not only their obligation to demonstrate and to educate people, but, you know, to advocate for how you can take the ideas they have on display and do those things at home. So a big shout out for public gardens and that.
It's funny. We recently had Leslie on the podcast, who's an old friend of yours, talking about planty travels, because she's doing this really epic jungle trip. But, you know, one of my favorite things when I'm traveling is to go look up the local botanical garden or plant shop or arboretum, something. So you kind of see because the crazy thing about the United States, I mean, we have an international audience, but the crazy thing about the United States is, I mean, there are so many different ecological regions of this country that look completely different. I, as a Northeasterner my whole life, the first time I went to Tucson, Arizona, I was like, I feel like I'm on Mars. Like, this is a completely different landscape. I wouldn't know where to begin. I feel so thirsty. I'm like looking at all the sand being like, where is the water? You know, you go to California, you have the same experience. Now in Florida, I'm looking at, you know, all the houseplants that I could only keep indoors are now all outdoor landscaping plants.
Right.
There's so much diversity in our country, and I find that fascinating. I don't know if we hear my puppy nephew, who I'm babysitting, is whimpering. But speaking of my puppy nephew and my bird that might also be in the background, you also talk in your book about, you know, pollinators are a big thing that everybody's talking about in pollinator plants, but also critters that are beyond that. Yes. So how do you build systems in my, you know, front yard or in my backyard that not just have intensive plants, but also have plantings or different spaces set up to support the local native wildlife as well?
I'm so glad you called that out, because obviously I'm proud of the whole book, but one of my favorite things that I got to do, I mean, the book is, for anybody out there kind of wondering what we're talking about, I mean, Your Natural Garden is kind of a collection of these little essays and reflections and glimpses, things that are, it's like a box of chocolates. You can kind of just let it
open. Yeah, it really is. And I learned so much. Sure. Yeah.
One of my favorite sections to write, and actually to research and then distill it into just a fraction of the words that we produced in the research, is actually on pages 68 and 69, for those following along at home, in a section called Creature Features. And the goal of that essay was to compile a list of things like, you know, the number and size of trees that are in your garden or your neighborhood, or, you know, the total amount of space you have covered by plants. These kind of sort of simple general ideas that the scientific literature tells us has meaning at that scale. You know, one of the things about ecology that can be a little difficult to get your mind around is that so much of the research that happens in ecology isn't just about studying, you know, one or a few organisms. It's looking at systems and the scale of interactions at a big, you know, a big scale. And so sometimes it can be hard to kind of tease out the signal, right? Like, what's actually happening here? Because there's a lot of stuff going on, right? A lot of, you know, ripple effects and butterfly effects and all those kinds of phenomenon that we kind of are fun to read about. And they happen every day in real time out there in the world. And so how do we start to make sense of that? And so sometimes it's helpful not to focus in on the smallest things, but actually just to kind of pull up at 30,000 feet and go, what are the big picture ideas? And so in that kind of essay, you know, we talk about everything from, you know, how much bare ground, because believe it or not, despite the fact that we've been talking about plants, you know, for half hour or so, actually having a little open ground in a few places is not a bad thing for a lot of creatures. A lot of ground nesting bees, wasps, they, you know, plants are great. They love plants, but they need like some open space.
Ants. I got so many ants.
Ants.
Like, yeah.
Ants are amazing. Like to be able to have just a space to get into the ground and do what they need to do, they need a little open space. So there's all these kinds of features. Water, of course. You know, like if you have water, you have life, right? I mean, we kind of need it if we're carbon-based life forms. Got to have water at some point. But, you know, so just thinking about all of those things, almost like if it were a checklist, that 2-page spread was to just be very straightforward and think about, like, can you just go through and can you account for some of these features that may exist in your landscape already? And if they don't, you know, that might be really easy to add. To embrace.
Yeah, no, I loved it. I thought that was really cool. And it makes you once again, like, open your mind beyond, okay, just native, like pollinator plants. It's like, no, creating an ecosystem, not just for pollinators, but for all of the local right. wildlife.
Right.
It's an ecosystem. It's yeah. not just a garden. It's really not. It's right. it's an ecosystem that you're
right.
creating.
Right. And you know, I think it's easy. And I think it's great if people find their way into this through various things, you know, whether it's pollinators or birds, you know, all that stuff's great. Those are all gateways, right? That's gateways into this. But like you just pointed out, I want to underscore how important that is. It's like, once you start focusing on one of these things, you, at some point, you know, your mind may start to go, what is the bigger picture that affects all of the stuff around this? What affects, you know, more, how far out do the ripples go from yeah. any drop in the water? And you start to realize, oh, this is a little bigger picture than just focusing on, do I have the, you know, the plants that the butterflies need to, you know, have their larval stage on? I mean, it's more than that. It's yes and, right? It's like that.
Yes and, totally. Yes.
Yes, and.
I can't believe we've been talking about plants for 40 minutes already, but I do want to ask you, you know, that look, that beautiful, wild, natural look. Could I ask you just in closing, like 3 tips? So it's hard because this whole very broad topic is never going to be really fully taught in a 40-minute podcast episode. But as where you've given us amazing resources to start looking more at our native plants, like what are 3 tips in your many years of experience that makes that natural look? Like something that comes to mind when I was looking at photos in your book is like, you're not planting in rows, you're planting in clumps, which is, you know, that new style. But if I wanted to take a stab in my garden, what are 3 ideas that you could give me?
Well, you know, under the guise of more plants, we can turn that into 2. One of which is more diversity, right? Is to increase the variety and thus the complexity of things in your landscape.
And okay.
So, particularly when those, you know, are native to your region and connected to your place and things that have resource value that other creatures can use, that, you know, increasing diversity is starting to move you already in the right direction. But, you know, even if you go down that route, you can't just have an arc garden that's just 2 of this and 2 of this and 2 of this. Like at some point, one of those, or probably a handful of those choices, have to be abundant.
And yeah.
That's a good thing for design, right? We talk about theme a lot in design. You know, interior designers talk about layering different, you know, kind of textures and colors and this sort of stuff. One that, you know, in an ecological sense out there in the landscape, we need abundance. We need at least a few species that are kind of everywhere in your garden. Maybe they're the theme that keeps the garden kind of feeling like it's yours. And so, you know, here we are, we've got density and diversity right out the gate, right? That there's 2 D's here that help move us in the right direction towards, you know, what ultimately is a very plant-driven, plant-forward, plant-led kind of aesthetic. And I would say the 3rd piece of that is, so when you put those 2 elements in the pot and you turn up the heat and watch the bubbles, the 3rd element of that is there are going to be some surprises. There are going to be some emergent properties, as we say in ecology, that are actually your secret sauce. Right. Like there are, I think the instinct about gardening sometimes is just the moment that things start to leave the realm we feel comfortable with, we pump the brakes, right? We think, oh, we gotta rein that in, gotta pull that, we gotta, you know, trim that, shear that, we gotta do something. And maybe that's okay. Maybe it's a question, maybe it's a point to say, what should I do here, instead of just jump to an action. But more often than not, you know, putting plants have just a little longer leash. Letting that thing reseed just a little bit more than you maybe think it should.
Letting it go to seed, like letting it.
Right. Just trust the lives of plants. You can always rein them in, right? Like that's just good gardening, right? You can always be the adjudicator when it comes down to it. At some point, like that that aesthetic, that style that people find so romantic and evocative is only possible from some level of abundance that's allowed to perpetuate and to sort of stay in motion.
And kind of letting go of the leash a little bit, like letting it get a little wild, letting it, because I think people get really scared to let it get a little wild or dare, like look a little ugly maybe for a minute as it continues to kind of iterate.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there is this, I've been writing and thinking a lot for various reasons lately about just sort of the aesthetics of ecology and maybe also the ecology of aesthetics and why we have to think about things. Why are we so concerned with the way things kind of look? And that's partly because that's just how we're wired, right? We experience the world through our senses. And so, you know, there's good reasons around all that. But there is something that I've talked about in the book called the bane of beauty, right? I mean, we just talk about gardens all day long, like they're either beautiful or they're not. And again, there's a real understandable reason for that. I just sometimes though want gardens to be interesting. Like there's plenty of art out there in the world that's not beautiful, that's meant to confront
you. Yeah, that's a great point.
Why can't our gardens have a little more of that, a little mystery that just sort of makes us wonder, what's up with that? Where's that going next? So I love that you said that because it's a heady topic, right? But it's interesting that gardens and landscapes get kind of reduced to either that binary of, oh, they're pretty or they're not. And I think that leaves a lot.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a small, the smallest of small scales. But right now I'm just growing in raised beds. I'm renting. And also Florida is entirely sand. Wow, that's new. So I'm just dealing with containers right now. And I had lettuce that bolted while I was away at Christmas. And instead of pulling it out, because I would always do that, because I just do vegetable gardens, I just let the lettuce bolt. I let it turn to flower. I'm watching the flower turn to seed now. It's been fascinating. It's not the most physical, it's not the most beautiful, right? Like my beautifully intensively planted little herb garden that it's sitting in.
Sure.
Not like old Maria wouldn't necessarily be excited about that. But I was like, I don't know, like, let's just see what it does. And maybe it'll attract some butterflies. Maybe it won't. I can always rip it out. I've almost ripped it out 3 times. But I don't know. I'm looking at it out my window right now. And I'm thinking, I think Kelly would like this.
It's we love brassicas and, you know, leafy greens. Of course, lettuce is in Nebraska. But any, you know, the leafy greens that you know, people don't expect to flower or, you know, surprised when they see something bolt for the first time. We love that. We love that. And there are oftentimes, particularly for brassicas, a great number of moths, particularly that need those resources for both nectar. And then they can, you know, larvally host on the plant as well. But I think they're kind of lovely. I think it's just a lovely phenomenon. It's a cycle to go through.
Yeah.
Sort of
to watch and to connect, right? Because if we're naturalizing our gardens because we want to connect more with the earth, we want to connect more to that naturalistic way, what's more of an opportunity to connect than to watch a plant go through its full life cycle, right? Exactly. And that's what I like when you were saying more plants, like in this style, you'll probably lose plants, but that's kind of a cool opportunity to see the plant's entire life cycle in an interesting way.
I couldn't agree more. I'm so glad you're making this point. The other night I was teaching, we teach an academy twice a year for more or less for folks who are working in landscape design about and wanting to build their professional credentials about this sort of stuff. But I was teaching earlier this week and I don't know why I came up with this analogy of soap operas because I don't even watch soap operas. I was trying to get across the point that like I think about, you know, our garden here at home is almost like a show, whatever, pick your show, right? And it's like every year is a new episode. The characters might be largely the same. Shaquille off Jennifer Coolidge, you know, might be largely the same, but they're doing different things. Storylines are different. You know, the plots are a little bit different. And that's sort of that's the best way I can think of off the cuff to think about how to frame the idea of a garden that's always in motion and always changing.
And they're different guest stars every year.
Right. 100%. This year.
One year it's the squirrels. One year it's the birds. One year it's the lettuce that bolted.
I love it. Special guest star, bolting lettuce.
Yeah, I love that. Oh, I love that. I love you. This was such a great conversation. I feel like we could have chatted for so much longer, but this is really a base foundation that if you guys listening are interested, your book really does dive deeper because this is a totally different approach to gardening than I think our parents did. Yeah. And there's unlearning, there's relearning, there's reframing. There's like a lot of interesting concepts here that are new or kind of remembered. So where can people find you and where can people find this great book?
I'm a daily poster on Instagram at Kelly D. Norris or near. I try to post every day. There's a lot to share. KellyDNorris.com. If folks want to learn more about our portfolio of work or reach out, you can pick up the book pretty much anywhere books are sold, both Your Natural Garden and my most recent book, New Naturalism, which is kind of the first part of this sort of two-part conversation around natural gardening and design. You can buy autographed copies on our website or, like I said, wherever books are sold. And I'm just really grateful for the opportunity to come share the message on your platform today.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, definitely. It's a great little coffee table book, too. There's a lot of visual inspiration in it, which for me was helpful as I'm like trying to grasp this concept a little more. Thank you, Kelly, for this wonderful conversation. He really had me inspired. Like I said, I've let stuff go to seed that I don't normally let go to seed. I'm definitely shopping and trying to find more native plantings, more plants that originate here that are lower maintenance. I don't know. He just really got me thinking. He's a really smart, heady guy. So you can go grab his book. It's going to be linked in the show notes. You can go follow him. All of his links are in the show notes. And I hope this conversation kind of inspired you as we're coming into the growing season, as we're coming into planting. I hope it makes you think and expands your kind of concept of what your garden could look like, as always, because I hope it helps you keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media, on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because plant friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible. So I made this cutie little plant parent personality quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up
like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.